Thank you all for coming. My name is Jeremy Beer. I'm introducing myself. I just done that. My name is Jeremy Beer. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. And it's an honor to be here. My first time attending a Saber convention. And I'm thankful to everybody who's made this convention possible and everybody who's made Saber what it is today. I should start by, I do want to recognize Larry Lester, who's in the audience here today. Without whom none of this research would have been possible at all. So thank you, Larry. I appreciate it. Yeah. Let's just talk about Larry for 20 minutes. Maybe that's a good show. I am going to talk to you for the next 20 minutes about Oscar Charleston. I've been on Oscar's trail for about the last 7 years, and it's all Bill James's fault. So I don't know about you, but one of the most surprising things I've ever read in a book about baseball was when I came across James's rankings of the top 100 players of all time in his new historical baseball abstract. Do you know the list I'm talking about? Anyone? Starts with, it's made in about 2001, starts with Babe Ruth at the top, and Honus Wagner, and Willie Mays, and then some guy named Oscar Charleston. And I had never heard of Charleston. And I don't really feel all that bad about it, because virtually no one I meet has ever heard of Charleston. The people in this room are exceptions, but will anybody cop to not knowing who Charleston was before this talk? All right, a few. You're weird. We're weird. No one else does. Even though Charleston was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1976. And even though a man as brilliant and knowledgeable as James ranked him as the fourth greatest player of all time, so I set out to do a little something about that by taking on the writing of Charleston's biography. It's the cover right here. It will come out on November 1st from the University of Nebraska Press. And what I discovered in uncovering the real historical Oscar Charleston is that many of the facts about him that circulate in the literature and on the internet are really just half-truths, legends, outright falsehoods. Very few people know much about Oscar, yet the reality is actually quite fascinating and inspiring. So I'm going to try to relay some truths about Charleston in contrast to three myths that are trivial in themselves, but will allow me to get to some interesting stuff and, frankly, just have the fun of sharing with you some of the photos and clippings and quotes I have collected over the last few years from old newspapers, interviews with ex-players, and especially Oscar's personal scrapbook and photo album, which are housed at the Negro Leagues Hall of Fame and Museum in Kansas City, but have rarely been looked at by researchers. The conclusion, to which all the evidence points, I believe, is that not only was Bill James right in ranking Charleston among the very best players who ever lived, but also, when you take into account Charleston's record as a manager and as a pioneering scout, he may have the most impressive resume ever put together by anyone, black or white, in a game of baseball. And I know that's a big claim, and you can tell me at the end whether I have sustained it. So sorry about the grainy photos. They are high-res enough for a 6x9 book, but not a 20-foot by 20-foot screen. Let's talk myths. The first one is that Charleston was a borderline psychopath who had an extensive criminal record and spent most of his time goading others into fights. Do a quick Google search on Charleston, and this is probably the impression you'll get. It's a view put out there by people like Mark Grabowski in his sometimes fanciful history of the Negro Leagues, a book that Larry says he always puts in the fiction section of a bookstore if he finds it in there. But anyway, this just isn't true. Let me give you a sense very quickly of who Oscar really was, and let's start with where he came from. Charleston was born on October 14, 1896. His middle name, McKinley, no doubt suggesting the Republican political affinities of his parents. The McKinley-Bryan presidential race was then in its final weeks. Here's where Oscar was born. My little laser pointer here. He was not born actually in this semi-trailer, but he was, at least not that I know of, but he was born on this now weedy, crumbling street on Indianapolis's Near East Side. The house is long gone, as are the hundreds of others that once made this one of Indianapolis's principal black neighborhoods. By the way, here are some other pictures of missing houses. I have at least 10 addresses at which Oscar lived as a youth in the city, and without exception, they're all gone. Now, Oscar did have a temper, and as I discovered, he came by it honestly. Here we have a clipping pertaining to his mother, Mary, who made the unwise decision of greeting a deputy on her doorstep with an axe. She got off easy on this one, fortunately. And she went on to become a highly respected leader of a black sororal organization, actually. Oscar was much like her in that he was given more to flares of temper than sustained anger. Three of Oscar's brothers had run-ins with the law as children and were sent for some amount of time to juvie. I really like this particular clipping. It seems that in 1900, Oscar's oldest brother Roy broke into a corner drugstore, apparently to steal a baseball. But despite these family issues, there is no record of Oscar getting into any similar kind of trouble. Now, perhaps the worst thing Oscar did as a youth was to lie his way into the army at the age of 15. He was assigned to the 24th Infantry and shipped to the Philippines, which is where he made his professional baseball debut. I'm showing you this particular letter because it is the first time we start to get a glimpse of Oscar's personality and his amazing ability to connect with people in positions of authority. The Captain Loving mentioned in this letter was Walter Howard Loving, well-known head of the Constabulary Band and one of the most prominent African Americans in the Philippines at the time. That Oscar befriended him says a lot about his charm and comportment. We see here the beginning of a pattern. Throughout his life, Oscar successfully associated himself with people of higher social position. I think that might have been hard for a thuggish psychopath to pull off. Oscar's first wife had the unpromising name of Hazel Grubbs. He married her in 1917, and she and her family fit the pattern I am talking about. The Grubbses were a prominent, highly cultured Indianapolis family whose names were always in the papers. Her father, William, was an educator. Her mother, Alberta, a musician. Oscar's second wife, shown here, Jane, was also of good family, and she was herself very intelligent and refined. Her father was a graduate of Clark University and an elder in the AME Zion Church in Harrisburg. Here she is with Oscar, with the wife of Dizzy Dismukes, and posing for a shot taken on the Charleston's honeymoon in Cuba. I just couldn't resist including this photo. One of Jane's friends back in Harrisburg was Esther Popel Shaw. If you know your Harlem Renaissance poetry history, you would know her name. Here she is, future poet of the Harlem Renaissance. And this is Jane in the middle, on the left in the second row. There's no way I couldn't show you this great photo of the 1915 girls basketball team. And one last piece of photographic evidence to show you how wrong the usual portrait of Oscar is. Two of Oscar's and Jane's best friends were James and Margaret Martin, whom they met in Cuba. James was a successful businessman, and Margaret was a journalist who wrote at least one article for her correspondent W.E.B. Du Bois's magazine, Crisis. The Martins were members of what has been called the Afro-Cuban elite, so, apparently, were the Charlestons. Now, none of this is to say that Oscar didn't like to fight. He fought quite a lot. But not because he was evil. In part, he fought on the field because he liked it. He absolutely loved boxing. There are numerous boxing-related clippings in his scrapbook. Here we see Oscar sparring with heavyweight champion George Godfrey, as well as a clipping about Oscar himself stepping into the ring in Cuba sometime in the 1920s. I don't know what happened in this fight. This clipping is in Oscar's scrapbook, and I wasn't able to find anything in the Cuban newspapers. Surely I just missed it. And probably wasn't so wise to get in the ring. But although Oscar liked to fight, his personality wasn't a violent one. Here was Pittsburgh Courier columnist Bill Nunn's take on Oscar. Says he is a rare specimen of one upon whom the gods have smiled in affable mood, and that Oscar's personality has won for him a warm spot in the hearts of each and every one of his players. This is no doubt exaggerated, but again, not what you would expect to be written about a berserker psychopath. More, just a few more quotes from Oscar from those who knew him. He like Will Rogers, he conquered them all and made them like it. He was jolly, he laughed really easy, he was intelligent with a beautiful personality, strict but very fair, and all he wanted us to do was don't cross him, and nobody did. The truth clearly is that Oscar was tough, strict, highly competitive, and sometimes hot-tempered, but fundamentally charming, amiable, and fair. That's the picture of his personality that we ought to have, and it's not currently out there. All right. The second myth you will encounter if you Google Oscar's name is that John McGraw said he was the greatest player he had ever seen. Bowie Kuhn repeated this claim at Oscar's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. The only problem is that there is no evidence McGraw ever said such a thing. The earliest this claim appears in the literature is 1939, and even then, it is pretty clearly apocryphal. But on the other hand, I was able to find this interesting document. On board this ship, which left for Key West from Cuba on March 1st, 1924, are the Charlestons, the second group right here, and none other than John and Blanche McGraw, right here. That's their son, Stephen, up there. The McGraws had been in Cuba for the last half of February, I was able to find out. And while there, they probably watched Charleston as he played the Santa Clara Leopardos, who were then finishing off one of the most legendary seasons in Cuban baseball history. They were sort of the equivalent of the 1927 Yankees in the Cuban popular mind. Charleston, of course, was the team's best player. In Havana's more relaxed racial atmosphere, it's possible that the McGraws and Charlestons had even mingled socially. We know that the Charlestons socialized with Adolfo Luque, then starring for the Cincinnati Reds, from photos in Oscar's personal photo album. In any case, if McGraw did say Charleston was the best he had ever seen, perhaps he said it directly to Oscar on this ship as it sailed to Key West. But of course, whether McGraw thought Oscar was the best he'd ever seen is somewhat immaterial. The testimony of many others who saw Oscar play is every bit as strong. Honus Wagner, for instance, knew a little something about baseball. Here he says, he's seen all the great players in many years, and yet to see one greater than Charleston. And I can throw you a bunch of other quotes. Benny Borgman, a scout for the Cardinals, went on to actually become a member of the National Basketball Hall of Fame. The greatest player he'd ever seen is Charleston, not excepting Ruth, Cobb, or Gehrig. Hollis Thurston, the pitcher, seen Ruth and Fox. Charleston was the greatest hitter. Happy Chandler, Buck O'Neill, Tom Baird, who didn't let a little thing like his membership in the Ku Klux Klan keep him from recognizing that Charleston was the greatest ball player that had ever lived. That's just crazy. Paul Derringer, Candy Jim Taylor, I can go on and on, Hank Greenberg, etc., and I won't. But I will just say that the breadth and depth of the testimony on Charleston's greatness is impressive and goes well beyond anything John McGraw may or may not have said. So much for verbal testimony. What do the stats indicate? It's a fascinating question. I wish I had more time to get into it. You can't read that, so don't worry about it. But let's just look at Oscar's Seamheads page, our best source for Negro League statistics. As you can see, or maybe not, in Negro League's competition, Oscar compiled a 353, 433, 580 slash line in 5,500 plate appearances. That's good for a 177 OPS plus. In other words, a career OPS 77% better than league average. And since this is just OPS, we are not counting what he contributed on defense or with his legs on the base paths. A 177 OPS plus, that's actually really good. It's the fourth highest career OPS plus in the Seamheads database. Oscar, by the way, is also a third all-time in batting average, fourth all-time in on-base percentage, and fourth all-time in slugging percentage.
Excuse me, are those Negro League
statistics? These are Negro League statistics only.
Okay.
Oscar is first all-time in the Negro Leagues in total plate appearances at bats, runs, hits, doubles, triples, home runs, RBIs, stolen bases, and walks. Have we left anything out? When we fold in base running and defense, Oscar ranks first all-time in WAR. It's not even particularly close. Obviously, we can't place a ton of confidence in these retrospective WAR calculations, but they're better than nothing. Third all-time in WAR per plate appearance behind only Josh Gibson and Cristobal Torriente. His peak was perhaps higher than anyone's. He has four of the best eight offensive seasons by OPS Plus in the Seamheads database. Four of the top eight. And in a seven-year span between 1919 and 1925, he posted an OPS Plus of 195 or above six times. No other player, not even Gibson, can say as much. When you take everything into account, offense, defense, base running, and longevity, Charleston makes a strong argument for having had the best all-around career in black baseball. Now, what does all this mean with respect to how Charleston would have fared in the majors? And that's too big of a question to delve into deeply here, and I'm not going to do fancy major league equivalencies or anything like that. But I will point out that when he faced major league teams in exhibition settings, of course, Charleston performed extraordinarily well in 111 plate appearances. 347, 418, 806. And some of those at-bats came against pitchers you've heard of, like, Lefty Grove, off whom he homered at least twice, and a number of others. We can also conservatively construct, with a little help from Sean Foreman's Baseball Reference Play Index, an alternative Major League Oscar and see how he stacks up. So my alternative Oscar has an OPS plus of 140. I've taken 37 points off him, which is about what Larry Doby and Monty Irvin experienced when they switched from the Negro Leagues to the white majors. 250 home runs and 400 stolen bases. Oscar had 178 and 280 in fewer than half the plate appearances of Willie Mays, so I think we're being conservative there and I've made him an average defender, right? D war of zero or greater, or at least a plus defender to neutral. How many major league players have put up that career line? Any guesses? Only Steroid Barry. No one other than Bonds has managed simultaneously to be that good on offense, on the base pass, and in the field. And I think we're being very conservative here. Bill James was right, at least among position players. There is little doubt that Oscar was a top five of all time sort of performer, and maybe even probably the best all-around player who ever lived, with apologies to Bullet Joe Rogan, Larry. The third myth, and we're finishing up here, once stated as fact by Monty Irvin and once put on the back of a National Baseball Hall of Fame bookmark, is that Oscar recommended Jackie Robinson to Branch Rickey. That isn't true. But what is true is that Oscar scouted for Rickey and that he provided critically important testimony that convinced Rickey to sign Roy Campanella. Furthermore, Oscar almost certainly did background work on all or nearly all of the Dodgers' first six black signees. And further yet, and I'm ready to be corrected on this point by somebody, I think he just may well have been the first African-American to be paid to scout for an American or National League team. Now, I can't back up all of those assertions in the time I have left, but let me just show you a few photos and provide a little context. First, in the early 1940s, Oscar was definitely a pioneer. This is the Quartermaster Depot team, which played in the Philadelphia Industrial League during World War II. Oscar played for the team and was its manager, visually represented in this great photo by its very placement in the shot. Now, how many black men had managed a racially integrated ball club in America, even one that was only semi-pro, by 1942? If you have a name of someone, I'd love to hear it. Charleston was really proud of this accomplishment, as the scrapbook proves. And by the way, his record as a manager in the Negro Leagues is excellent. He managed four championship-winning teams for the Pittsburgh Crawfords and Indianapolis Clowns. And in what may have been the only poll ever taken of Negro Leagues players on the matter, he was voted the best manager in Negro Leagues history. One of his managerial gigs was for the Brooklyn Brown Dodgers in the short-lived United States League. Here he is signing his contract. It was a big deal in the black press. Originally, Oscar was supposed to manage the league's Philadelphia entry, but my research suggests that Branch Rickey insisted that he manage the Brooklyn Brown Dodgers instead. Rickey, it seems, trusted Oscar, and with him as his manager, Rickey could easily leverage the knowledge, insights, and connections of the Negro League's most respected figure. Just how the arrangement worked is obscure, but there is evidence that Oscar met directly with Rickey from time to time. And I would point out that the two men must have seemed much to like in one another. They were both teetotalers, Republicans, and ambitious believers in the value of hard work. In any case, Dodgers scout Clyde Supeforth told the Sporting News in July 1951 that Rickey had, quote, hired Oscar because he, quote, could get in clubhouses and find out facts in the Negro Leagues. He knew all the people in black baseball, said Supeforth, and if we got interested in somebody, why, we'd call Oscar. In short, the evidence suggests that Oscar was the first black man ever to be paid to scout for a white major league team. His service for the Dodgers predated by 4 years John Donaldson's for the White Sox, by 5 years Judy Johnson's for the Athletics, and by 8 years Quinty Trout's for the Cardinals, to name just a few other early black scouting pioneers. So there you have it. Oscar Charleston was not a psychopath, but a charming, attractive, widely admired leader. He put up incredible numbers, and we have strong eyewitness testimony to his greatness both in America and in Cuba. He was a championship-winning, highly respected manager who may have even broken a color line of sorts in that role, and he almost certainly broke a color line as a scout. Just at a glance, wouldn't you say that we have here one of baseball's greatest resumes? And wouldn't you say that's an American legacy worth knowing? Thanks. Sure. Now, the white man is Joseph Hall. He owned the team, ends up later suing Branch Rickey for not reimbursing his expenses or something there. He was a crook. Charleston thought he was a crook. And the black man in that photo is Webster McDonald, former Negro Leagues pitcher. And he was he became the manager of the Hilldale entry in the league.
The one photo looks like he may have been older with the other infielders.
Yeah.
It looks kind of heavy.
Yeah. What, he got fat.
What position did he actually play?
First base. Yeah. When Charleston comes up as a center fielder, Actually, comes up as a pitcher. And that's how C.I. Taylor first used him for the Indianapolis ABCs in 1915. He really made his name on the mound in the Philippines. But he was just too good a hitter to waste on the mound and tire out that way. So he put him in center field. He stays in center field until he goes to Homestead Grays in 1930 when he switches to first base, and that's the position he plays for the rest of his career. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
So he's pretty old. In that photo there, he's like 46 years old, 45 or 46.
So that would minimize his defensive prowess a little.
Yeah, he gained very quickly a good reputation as a first baseman, but certainly his defensive value went down dramatically after 1930, but by that time he'd already put up 15, 16 great years in center field, so...
I know his stats were a little bit incomplete, obviously, yes. As all the Negro League players were. Right. What's the percentage of games that we know that have been found through archives?
Well, that's a question maybe more for Larry than for me. I think my guess of the games against top-tier competition, Negro Leagues play, what do you think, Larry? Do we have maybe 70% of those box scores, you think, 80?
In the 20s, they had explicit coverage we found. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good question. Behind you? Yeah. Most of his teammates liked him, actually. I can only find two players who didn't. Vic Harris and Judy Johnson were not big fans. And Buck Leonard didn't like how he went into bases spikes up. Now, it wasn't the Leonard way. But he was actually pretty, especially later on. Well, he was widely respected, I would say, and admired. He had their back. He really forged the Crawfords into a true team. If you read oral history from that team, he's often praised for helping to really forge their identity. And getting them to play together, which was an important part, of course, of baseball at the time, maybe more than it is now. And really bonded them on the road through long southern road trips that were under terrible conditions, of course, traveling. I think he saw that as great team bonding opportunities. So he was generally liked, to answer your question, and highly respected, with a couple of exceptions. How important was it to have him?
Yes.
It wasn't.
Can you talk about that season?
That season. I can't talk about it probably in depth. He goes back to the ABCs in 1920, of course. So Rube Foster forms the Negro National League in early 1920 at the Kansas City YMCA. And he generously allows the newspaper men there to kind of distribute the talent across teams, because he knew everybody was going to think this is all just about Rube Foster. And so Charleston had been on Rube Foster's Chicago American Giants in 1919. So he goes back to Indianapolis in 1920, and C.I. Taylor gets back into the Negro Leagues game in 1920. He'd been out for a year himself. So he was important for Indianapolis being a... Without him going back to Indianapolis, C.I. Taylor may not have gotten back into the game. Maybe Indianapolis isn't even in the league. I don't know if I'm answering your question. He had a really good year in 1920. It's in his peak period, 1919 to 1925. Yeah, he was probably the best player in Negro Leagues baseball in 1920, with the possible exception of Cristobal Torriente, among position players, I would say. We done? I'm supposed to stop. Mike says stop. Happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.